Welcome to the Peak Demand Podcast. My name is Robert Cox, and I'm here today with my colleagues Christina Capitopoulou and Jim Gafford. Our topic today is the energy transition. So Jim and Christina, can you guys kind of frame that discussion for us a little bit today?
Sure. We have been talking about the energy transition for a while, so I think most people know what we're talking about. But really, it's just the global move from fossil fuel generation and consumption to more renewables like wind and solar. So depending on who you ask, you will get a lot of different answers about if it's just renewables or if it's overall clean energy. So that would include a lot of different sources and not just wind and solar, for example. With that, Jim, what do you think?
First, when you say, hey, there's a lot of people that have a lot of different ideas, I think that highlights the fact that there is not a consensus opinion on how to make an energy transition work. I won't say there's unanimous consensus, but there is certainly a overwhelming consensus that there needs to be an energy transition away from carbon-based fuel sources. You know, with that, I'm still left with, okay, we can talk about generation from solar, we can talk about generation from wind, and how we would have this hybrid system of generation, which could make our generating capacity more reliable, or at least more resilient through hybridization. But there's another component that I'm left wondering about, which is how does the infrastructure evolve to manage these disparate resources? And then how do you actually deliver energy to the users? And what do those users' applications look like and how they're going to evolve in the future? So one, what are your thoughts on what the network looks like? And two, how is the energy transition going to work to map to a more electrified system and growing demand for electric energy use?
I think it depends on where we really will see generation in the end. Again, depending on who you ask, it's all going to be either microgrids or bigger and better transition lines. But there is stranded assets, right? Coal plants are being shut down. It seems like natural gas will also be phased out. So what do you do with those stranded assets? Maybe there is talks about putting nuclear there. There is talks about putting other types of generation there. And then when we're talking about electrification, it's not just vehicles. We're going to be seeing a lot of different things, right? That the appliances or anything you can change from a fossil fuel-based generation or propulsion, if you will, to something that is either electricity or a different fuel. It's a very interesting topic.
I agree. It's an interesting topic. You know, I keep hearing and I'm very interested personally in energy storage as somehow the solution for a lot of these challenges that we see with renewables. But I must say, you know, I'm still a bit of a skeptic on how all this is going to come to pass. Energy storage is starting to look like fusion in some ways, where it's always 2 weeks away and yet we still don't have really viable options for the network. But Rob, what are your thoughts?
Well, there's a lot to digest here. There's a lot of questions, a lot of things that need to be thought through to make that transition happen. And I think today's guest can help to shed some light on some of those questions, and particularly what's going on in California. I'd like to welcome Zeke Hausfather. Zeke is the Director of Climate and Energy at the Breakthrough Institute. Zeke is a climate scientist and energy systems and analyst whose research focuses on observational temperature records, climate models, and mitigation technologies. He spent 10 years working as a data scientist and entrepreneur in the clean tech sector, where he was the lead data scientist at ESSIS, the chief scientist at C3.ai, and the co-founder and chief scientist of Efficiency 2.0. He also worked as a research scientist with Berkeley Earth, was a senior climate analyst at Project Drawdown, and the U.S. analyst for Carbon Brief. He has master's degrees in environmental science and a PhD in climate science from the University of California at Berkeley. Zeke, welcome to the Peak Demand Podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Terrific. So, you know, we wanted to talk with you a little bit about just some of the challenges associated with the energy transition. California is sort of the test bed for so much of that. And we really appreciate having you on to kind of talk about some of the challenges there. One of the things that I was at a presentation on recently here was someone talking about the duck curve phenomenon that's occurring here now in North Carolina. And I'd never heard of it in North Carolina. So I was wondering if you could maybe kind of briefly describe for our listeners what the duck curve is.
Sure. So the duck curve is a graph that was originally created, I believe, back in 2013, sort of looking at what would happen, or maybe it was even as far back as 2010, looking at what would happen in California as a lot more renewables came online. And specifically, what the duck curve is showing is what they call net load. So the amount of non-intermittent generation on the grid over time, over the course of a typical day. The original duck curve was for a spring day, which is where the effects are most pronounced because demand is fairly low. Now, in California, at least, we're seeing, you know, noticeable duck curves in every month of the year. And essentially what the duck curve shows is that, you know, as the sun rises and solar generation comes online, which is the biggest source of renewables in California and the fastest growing source generally, what we see is a large decline in non-intermittent generation and getting quite low by the middle of the day. But then as the sun sets, everyone gets home, turns on their ovens, turns on their lights, turns on their TV, plugs in their electric vehicle increasingly. Suddenly you have a very large jump in non-intermittent demand. And so the solar generation is being replaced by things like natural gas. The sort of ramp up between the midday and the evening gets progressively larger as more solar goes online.
So basically what's happening is as the sun goes down and load is increasing, we're having to fire up potentially dirty resources to be able to pick up the loss of generation that's occurring.
Today, yes. You know, ultimately, we want to figure out ways to have firm and dispatchable clean resources, be that batteries, be that large-scale transmission, so we can get extra nighttime wind from Iowa to evening peaks in California, or some other generation technologies, such as natural gas with carbon capture and storage, enhanced geothermal, advanced nuclear, et cetera, that can sort of meet these demand peaks, these non-intermittent demand peaks, without producing emissions.
Recently in California, there was a, you know, quote, heat storm. And you and some of your colleagues wrote an article about this. And that, to me, was really a good way of framing the challenges that come in with everything that you just really excellently described. So can you talk a little bit about that particular event and what the challenges were that kind of led to some rolling blackouts?
Yeah, so there were 2 days in a row of brief rolling blackouts in California, which is the first time that's really happened in over a decade. And, you know, overall, the event wasn't too terrible for the residents of California. The blackouts were quite brief. They haven't reoccurred since then. But it shows more broadly that, you know, there's a lot of new stresses on our power grid associated with this energy transition and with the phenomenon of climate change happening at the same time, that we really need to better account for in our planning. And so specifically what happened in those days is we had unprecedented levels of heat in California. We had really high demands. I think it was the second highest demand on record after, I think, 2016 for that time of the year. At the same time, we had a heat wave blanketing much of the Southwest US. And traditionally what California has done is it's relied a lot on imports from neighboring states in order to meet sort of the evening ramp up of generation. So in the middle of the day, California imports almost nothing from its neighboring states. In fact, in most days, it is a net exporter, putting large amounts of solar to neighboring states. But as soon as the sun sets, it suddenly starts sucking a ton of electricity from places like Nevada. About a third of generation, of all generation in California, is coming from imports in that time of the day when solar generation is low. What happened on that particular day is because there was a very large heat wave affecting the entire region, the availability of imports, which was much smaller than it would have usually been. While there was, in theory, enough capacity within the state to meet the very high levels of demand, we also had an unexpected drop in wind generation relative to forecasts. We had a couple gas plants unexpectedly go offline, in part related to the extreme heat, which can affect the generation of gas plants. Combination of all of these different things led to a crisis where they had to shed load and have rolling blackouts in order to make sure that there wasn't a wider spread grid failure.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between actually energy and capacity? We have a lot of students also that listen to our podcast, so it's good to kind of differentiate between the two. And what do you mean by each?
Of course. So when we're talking about energy, we're talking about how much is actually being produced by a given power plant at a given time, or the total production over some increment of time. When we talk about a certain amount of kilowatts, that's the instantaneous generation. If we talk about kilowatt hours or kilowatt, you know, hours over a period of time, that's the aggregation of energy. But when we talk about capacity, what we're talking about is the potential maximum generation of a plant. In the US right now, for example, we have a lot of coal plants, but the coal plants we have are operating only at about 50% capacity, which means they're only running at about half the time that they could operate. Similarly, our gas plants these days are only running at about 50% capacity. Nuclear plants tend to be closer to 100% capacity, in part because they don't ramp up and down very easily, and it doesn't make much sense to ramp them up and down when you can avoid it. And renewables are a slightly different beast, because while most types of traditional generation, the operators have a choice of what capacity factor to operate at, renewables, you don't really have a choice, right? You know, your solar power is generating power based on how much sun is hitting it. And so while the capacity factor of solar might be around 18%, what that really means is that on average, over the entire day, the solar panel's producing about 18% of what it produces at its peak when the sun is directly overhead and shining directly on it. And so when we talk about capacity, we have to keep in mind that renewables, intermittent renewables in particular, are slightly different than traditional energy sources in that we can't necessarily control when they generate power. And that's really important to take into account. We're trying to balance all the different energy sources to make sure that the power stays on.
Put the economics aside for a moment. Say we've got a grid that has the capacity to support whatever demands by whatever resources are out there. Is the public more interested in making sure the lights stay on or interested in using the renewable resources we have? Because while you may not be able to get everything you can out of solar when you need it, you can throttle it and supplement during the peak periods with, let's say, more conventional means. Is that one solution to solving the duck curve problem?
It definitely is. You know, in many ways, America is very well positioned to have a high amount of renewables on our grid, in large part because we have so much natural gas. And unlike things like coal and nuclear, where you have to pay a very large amount of money to build a plant up front, and you're losing money when you're not operating it, essentially, in most cases. Natural gas is relatively cheap to build. The capital costs are low, and most of the costs are variable costs. Most of the cost of operating a gas plant is burning that gas. And so if your gas plant is only running 10, 20, 30% of the time because you have a ton of renewables and other times, that doesn't really hurt the economics that much because you're also paying those gas operators a lot more for those small percent of the time when you really need them. And so we have a lot of capacity to fill in these gaps. And so I don't think we necessarily need to choose between keeping the lights on and having a lot of renewables on the grid, at least today. As we start getting closer to 100% clean energy, we start getting a lot more challenges without more of this clean, firm generation or cheaper battery technology or a combination of all these different things. And I think if it does become a question between keeping the lights on and cutting our emissions, I suspect keeping the lights on will win. You know, as we saw last time in California, when there was a real crisis around our electricity production, we recalled the governor. It was a huge political mess. I think that people are willing to pay more money. I think people are willing to take some sacrifices in order to decarbonize our electricity generation. I think it might be a big ask if we're having to deal with, you know, more frequent blackouts. But again, I don't think that's necessarily a problem that is going to continue. I think that we've reached a point in California where the transition is happening so fast that in some ways our firm dispatchable resources haven't kept up with it, and we need to do better on that front. But it's a very easily solvable problem. It's not a fundamental limitation of renewables, at least at penetration levels we see today.
And I don't mean this to actually be a political question, but I think it certainly could be. Some of the adoption of new technologies in, let's say, a quasi-regulated market are based on some policymaker's decision. If there was one thing that you could do to inform the vote, I feel like a lot of the challenge we have are due to policymakers not understanding the technologies that they're wanting to provide. If there was one or two things that you could say, I need the public to understand this, and this will make our utility more reliable or less dirty, or whatever goal that you would have, what would it be?
Sure. I'd really say two things, you know, particularly involving a lot of the conversations around policy we're having today with the election and everything else. One is that we really need better transmission to support the energy sources of the future. Our electricity grid was most of it was built in the 1940s. Much of it hasn't been upgraded since then. And it's very balkanized. You know, we don't really have the ability to get electricity, large amounts of electricity over very long distances, particularly across grid borders. And so a world where we're relying a lot more on these intermittent electricity sources like wind and solar is really one that would benefit from the ability to send extra sun and extra wind over long distances. And so investing in modernizing our grid is huge if we really want to, you know, make this energy transition much more seamless. The second area where I think policy can get in the way of progress is if we're trying to get rid of fossil fuels quickly, you know, for example, in the new Biden plan to get to zero emissions in the power sector by 2035, we really need to prioritize the dirtiest and least flexible sources first. So there's been a lot of talk about banning fracking, for example, by Democratic candidates. The Biden and Harris are not necessarily for it, but a lot of folks on the left are. If we were to ban fracking tomorrow, what would happen is we'd see a massive resurgence in coal, right? As I mentioned earlier, all our coal plants are operating at 50% capacity on average today. You know, they could easily scale that up pretty quickly if gas prices go up. And historically, you've seen just that. Whenever gas prices rise, coal generation rises in tandem. And so if we want to effectively decarbonize our electricity sector and rely on a lot of renewables at the same time, we really need to prioritize closing our coal first and closing our gas later. Once we have better storage of electricity, once we have better large distance transmission, and once we have other clean firm generation alternatives that can fill in the gaps. Because right now, for better or worse, gas plays a really important role in filling in the gaps in renewable generation. And we don't have mature technological solutions to do that at a very large scale quite yet. We have seen a lot of very impressive progress in batteries, and a lot of folks are hopeful that in the next few years, we'll start to see some really big battery projects that can start replacing gas for sort of peaking purposes.
To touch a bit on that, if I'm correct, California has still one nuclear plant that's operational, which is also set to shut down earlier than it was initially expected. So when we're talking about baseload generation, nuclear and carbon, you know, zero carbon, but now they're shutting it down, what are your thoughts on that? Would keeping nuclear on be a good solution to keeping that baseload generation until the technologies are more mature to really help with the different peaks, like the evening peak, for example?
So if you're trying to decarbonize the power sector as quickly as possible, shutting down clean generation makes absolutely no sense. And we've seen the pitfalls of doing this in other countries. Germany, in many ways, led the world in deploying renewable energy and spent an enormous amount of money to make clean energy cheap or renewable energy cheap. But at the same time, they shut down almost all of their nuclear. And so actual carbon dioxide emissions in Germany have not fallen much at all. In fact, the U.S. has seen bigger declines in emissions than Germany, in part because Germany has kept their coal plants open and shut down their nuclear plants, whereas the U.S. has shut down our coal plants and replaced them with gas and renewables while mostly keeping our nuclear plants open, though we've started to see some retire. In fact, there is a real worry that if we go ahead with rapid nuclear retirements, we might set back a lot of the progress we're making in decarbonization. Right now, there's an equivalent amount of nuclear generation that is scheduled to retire as all of our current solar energy generation in the US. We certainly could replace that nuclear with other clean energy sources if it makes financial sense, but it's really hard to make that case. And it's really especially hard to make that case if we're still operating all these coal and gas plants. If you are concerned about nuclear energy, we can have that debate, but let's get rid of coal, gas, and oil first, and then worry about which clean energy source is best. Building new nuclear is a much bigger challenge, particularly conventional nuclear reactors, just because they've proven so expensive. You know, there are a lot of companies working on small and modular reactor designs, essentially trying to take inspiration from the success of renewables, that if you can really have an assembly line for these sort of things, rather than these giant bespoke public infrastructure projects, you can keep costs down much more effectively. And a lot of folks are hopeful that next decade we'll start to see some more small and modular reactors appearing. But in the short term, at least, you know, the big question is around keeping our existing reactors open. And I think they're California really did a disservice by focusing on closing nuclear before getting rid of fossil fuels.
You touched on energy storage a moment ago, and you mentioned batteries. And I see a lot of press releases on new battery installations, new battery installations, new battery installations. And you know, personally, I'm still a little lukewarm, at least, on battery as an energy storage technology because of a lot of challenges. So first, I want to talk about what your views are on how you monetize battery energy storage. There's a lot of risk involved with it. And if we're looking at grid scale systems, we're looking at tens to hundreds of megawatt hours to gigawatt hours of storage. Does battery really make sense? There are other technologies. Pumped hydro and compressed air have been around for a long time. So why aren't we seeing more of those type things being brought online if we're looking at very large scale energy storage?
That's a good question. I mean, pump hydro in particular is a great technology. The challenge with pump hydro, though, is that it requires very specific geologies, or not geologies per se, but you need reservoirs with a big height differential, and that those are only available in certain regions. There's some big limitations and simply on the availability of pump storage hydro potential that come into play. But on the battery front, the reason I'm somewhat optimistic on batteries is that we've seen remarkable cost declines there. Battery prices today are lower than people thought they'd be in 20, 30, 5 or 6 years ago. And a lot of this is being driven not necessarily by energy storage for grid applications, but by consumer electronics, by electric vehicles, by all of these things that are driving incredibly large production volumes of lithium ion batteries and the development of newer chemistries that can be, you know, hold charges longer, recharge and have longer lifetimes. And so, you know, I think the economics of batteries are getting to the point, they're not quite there today, but if we see the rate of price falls that we've seen over the last few years continue, you know, we'll get to the point where they are cost competitive against gas for certain peaking uses today. I think the bigger challenge with battery storage is around the seasonal storage question, because one of the challenges with renewables is you don't have the same level of solar generation in the summers and the winter. And for that matter, you don't have the same level of wind generation in the summers and the winter. The two tend to reverse. You know, you get more wind in the winter and more sun in the summer, which balances each other out a little bit. But you still end up having in a high renewable grid a challenge where you need, particularly a high solar grid, where you need more electricity in the winter than the solar panels can easily produce. The ability to store energy and use it in particular seasons, like we can do with natural gas, for example, is something that where we don't have good solutions for battery storage today. The battery storage we're primarily talking about is for short-term storage. A lot of the early batteries been installed, for example, in Australia, have really benefited from auxiliary grid services as well. You know, they provide things like frequency regulation, but that is a low-hanging fruit where, you know, the first battery gets a big benefit from that, the second battery gets some benefit from that, the nth battery gets no benefit from that. And so the economics of batteries will get a little worse as we start getting more and more on the grid. And so the real question is, are prices going to fall fast enough that it starts making sense as we get more and more batteries to continue using lithium ion batteries as a primary grid storage mechanism? I think it will if prices continue on the trend they've been in the last few years, but again, it just remains to be seen.
Following on to that a little bit, I mean, so then, you know, in California, it seems like one of the big issues has been, there's been a real big emphasis on how much energy we get out of renewable energy. There hasn't been as much focus on the capacity side. And we've talked a little bit about some of the technologies here, you know, batteries and natural gas. To get to kind of a cleaner way to be able to deal with the dispatchable resources that we need to ride through those capacity peaks when we need capacity, what do you see then as the technologies that we really need to get? I mean, it's got to be kind of a combination of things, right? You know, what do you see?
Yeah, you know, there's no single technology that will be a silver bullet here, right? It's a combination of really three things. Better transmission, for one, being able to get excess power from larger regions further away. And Europe has really done a great job with this in balancing renewables, higher levels of renewables across European countries. You can get an immense amount of extra pump storage hydro from Norway to Germany, for example, or get extra wind from Spain or solar from Spain. And they've invested a lot more in high voltage direct current transmission. The US has. China as well has really built out immense amounts of very large scale transmission. And so, you know, there are good examples to follow there. Storage is important, both the type of lithium ion battery storage we've been talking about, and also some emerging technologies around flow batteries and potential longer scale storage technologies that, you know, we'll see if they end up making economic sense or not, but there's certainly a lot of exciting work being done there. And then the third area that we really need is more firm, clean, dispatchable generation. And there's somewhat fewer options. If we can get carbon capture and storage with natural gas to be cost effective, and there are some new technologies like the alum cycle plants that are promising there, you know, that could really allow us to essentially continue using gas in the way we are today, but while minimizing emissions. And so that would, you know, make things a lot easier. Enhanced geothermal is something that a lot of people are really excited about. Now we're sort of using a lot of the technologies that we pioneered for the natural gas industry around horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing in order to be able to extract heat from rocks that we wouldn't have been able to a decade ago. And so there's a lot of potential there, particularly in the Western US, that can be explored. And that is an always on, always available clean generation. And then, you know, there is this question mark around nuclear. Like, can we drive down the cost of new reactors or develop new advanced reactors that can really help the load following, help fill in the gaps with renewables? It's not going to happen tomorrow, but there's a lot of companies and a lot of money is trying to pursue that. What is clear is that, and a lot of grid modelers like Jesse Jenkins and others find this, is that if you really want a decarbonized electricity system, you need a solid chunk. And by solid, I mean 30-40% of clean, firm generation. You can't easily just have all wind, water, and solar power your electricity grid, at least not at a reasonable cost.
One thing that we talk a lot about here, because we're in Charlotte, which is sort of the hub of the nuclear industry, is that question around dispatchable nuclear and whether SMRs are going to get there. you know, so this is kind of a technology question, I guess, but I mean, do you see that as realistic that we're going to have dispatchable nuclear?
I think it's tough. And to be honest, how dispatchable the nuclear is, I'm not sure matters that much. Because again, nuclear is all about fixed costs, right? It costs a lot to build these plants. Even the SMR plants are going to be, you know, capital costs will be a very large portion of the lifetime plant cost. And you still need a fair number of employees. Today, a typical 1 gigawatt nuclear plant has 700 employees. A typical 1 gigawatt gas plant has 23 employees. The salary costs are actually, for a nuclear plant today, are a sizable portion of the overall cost. They're about a third, I think, of the price that a gas plant pays for its gas is just the salaries for people working at a nuclear reactor. And those fixed costs, even if you have the reactor running at lower output or even completely turned off, don't go away. And so the challenge nuclear has with load following or with sort of ramping down is because uranium is so cheap, you're not really saving that much money when you're not generating electricity. And so where that leaves nuclear is essentially, what do you do with extra electricity from your nuclear reactor when you don't need it? Are there other things you can do? Can you produce heat, for example, for industrial processes? Can you power direct air capture of CO2? Can you produce hydrogen? Can you do desalinization? Can you do some of these other sort of big energy intensive loads when you have extra electricity in a way that's cost effective? And that's a big question mark. I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll be able to at least drive down the costs of nuclear with next generation reactors and sort of move away from these mega projects of death that we've seen with the current generation of reactors that are 5 years behind schedule and three times over budget. But I think the exact role nuclear plays in a future grid remains to be seen a little bit and sort of depends a bit on what the alternatives are for clean dispatchable power. You know, a world with ubiquitous dirt cheap gas with carbon capture and storage is a world where we probably need less nuclear than a world where that technology doesn't manifest itself, for example. Nuclear is not the perfect complement to variable renewable energy, but it certainly can play a role as a complement, particularly if there aren't many other options available.
So you mentioned earlier high voltage transmission lines. I want to take you on the other side. What are you thinking about microgrids? Do they fit in the future of energy and the energy transition?
So that's a good question. Today, most microgrids that exist are diesel powered. This idea that microgrids mean clean energy is not necessarily true today. There are a lot of benefits of microgrids for resilience. You know, my power went off yesterday because of high wildfire risk. PG&E cut off our power. And so I fired up my little gas generator and had it as a little home microgrid. And more people are doing things like solar and storage for their homes, or even like small scale community microgrids. So the challenge with doing a small-scale community microgrid, at least outside of the residential space, is loads are large enough that it becomes tough to install enough storage to support, say, a solar microgrid for an entire town. That would be really expensive. And so there's really good reasons to remain connected to the grid, even if you have a world where a lot more people are producing electricity through solar on their rooftops, for example, simply because it requires a lot more storage locally to be completely self-sufficient. You certainly can have some sort of hybrid solution where you have some local islanding and storage capacity, but not fully islanding local communities. So to be more resilient in the case of power cutoffs. But I don't think it makes sense to really plan for a world where every town is its own completely isolated grid. And it's also, that would also just be a much more expensive way to generate power. Like today in the US, utility scale solar is one third the cost of rooftop solar on average. And the reason for that is because two-thirds of the cost of rooftop solar is what we call soft costs. It's the cost of actually getting someone on your roof, putting in scaffolding, installing the panels. The panels themselves are dirt cheap. And so when you're building a utility scale solar farm, the soft costs of installing the panels per panel, per watt generated, or per kilowatt generated over the lifetime is much, much lower than if you're doing it on residential rooftop. There's reason to think that most of our generation going forward will be large scale, utility scale, not sort of small community scale, just because that's, as far as we can tell, the most cost-effective way to decarbonize.
This conversation started in California. We touched on North Carolina a little bit, and I do kind of want to draw us back towards the other half of the country, if you will, if we consider that only the other half of the country practically lives outside of California. A lot of the questions that are driving this conversation in California, whether it be wildfires and duck curves and whatnot, aren't necessarily related to either decarbonization or renewables. it's a factor of just the population that is there. And that is driving the adoption of cleaner technologies in many cases, and that's great. Climate change, on the other hand, is one of these things which is a, I don't think it's as big a political hot topic anymore. More and more people are finally coming on board with a cleaner world is a better world to live in. That being the case, what are the things in the environment that are going to, and I mean the cultural environment, that are going to drive the public to get behind the adoption of more cleaner generating technologies? Again, in California, it seems to be driven by the environment that you live in. Hey, things catch on fire, we need to figure out how to stop this. Outside of California, that's not necessarily the case. It's a long-winded question, I know.
It's a good question, though.
But, but what's going to, you know, what are the things that can help drive or will help drive the public to wanting to adopt cleaner energy-producing technologies? Because the things that are going to drive the public to do it are going to be the things that are going to lead policy changes that are going to allow for those, that adoption.
And I think there's also an important corollary to that question is what is going to lead to adoption of those technologies by places like India, China, Indonesia? Because climate change is a global issue, right? If we really want to solve it, we can't just have clean energy in the US. We need to have clean energy around the world. And so I think the single biggest thing to get large-scale public adoption of clean energy technologies and sort of this energy transition is to make clean energy cheap. And we have been remarkably successful, much more than many of us thought would be possible, at making clean energy cheap over the last decade. Texas is a renewable energy mecca, not because all of the legislators in Texas are, you know, hippies who want to protect the environment, but simply because wind in Texas, and to some extent solar these days, is cheaper than coal. And so if you want red states to move away from coal to adopt renewables, you need to make them cheaper than what they're using today, and you need to make them as easy to use as what they're using today. That's generally true across a range of different decarbonization solutions. If you want people to buy more efficient light bulbs, you need to make them as cheap as what they're doing today and more reliable. When you're asking people to make sacrifices, when you're asking people to wear sweaters and turn down the heat, then it's a lot harder to get public buy-in for these sort of things. There's an important role for policy in pushing technology and making technology cheaper and getting these economies of scale. There's an equally large role for innovation, for more cost-effective deployment, for learning by doing, and for technology itself in getting us to these goals. That's probably what makes me optimistic, regardless of what happens in this election, is we're really seeing technology starting to become the driving force of emission reductions. A great example of this actually is the fate of coal. The Trump administration came into office arguing that they're gonna end Obama's war on coal. Coal jobs are coming back. Coal is gonna make a return. It turns out that we actually shut down more coal at a faster rate during the Trump administration than we did during the Obama administration. Not because of any efforts of the Trump administration. In fact, the exact opposite. They rolled back every regulation they could find that might get in the way of coal. But simply because coal is more expensive than gas and renewables these days, and that's not going to change anytime soon. And so the great thing about making clean energy cheap is it ends up being much more resilient to sort of the twisting winds of political whims than any other sort of policy solution. That's not to say that it's going to solve the problem by itself, but it's an important part of it.
Zeke, I'd like to thank you for coming on the podcast here with us today. It's been great. I could keep going with this conversation for a while. A lot of good answers, and there's a lot we could talk about.
Definitely. Yeah, it's been great to be on.
As we conclude, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that the views and opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of EPIC, the William States Lee College of Engineering, or UNC Charlotte. We look forward to seeing everyone again, or listening to everyone again, or having them listen to us again, I guess, on our next episode of the Peak Demand Podcast.